Welcome to EcoTalk, a very special edition. I think you're going to want to sit tight, turn up the radio, and tell your friends and family to gather around. We have a very exciting first segment, at least, and continuing through the show, I think you'll agree. We're going to be speaking with Jeff Kluger of Time Magazine. He'll be joining us to discuss their groundbreaking cover story out this week on global warming's arrival. Half the April 3rd issue is devoted to this huge story, something we talk about week in, week out on EcoTalk, but the fact that it is getting such big play in such a big mainstream magazine such as Time is huge news, and we're going to find out what's behind the decision to devote so much of this issue to the biggest environmental challenge of our time. Then we'll switch gears, and on a slightly lighter note, we'll be speaking with Kimberly Ryder. She's written a book on healthy home workbooks. It's all about how to start cleaning up your environment beginning in your own backyard. We'll also be hearing from the NRDC's Daniel Heinerfeld. He'll be reporting on how strip mines are affecting Hopi and Navajo water supplies. And finally, in our partners segment, Kate Clancy, author of a recent Union of Concerned Scientists report, shows the environmental and health benefits of shifting cows to grass diets. But first, I'd like to recognize those who are making EcoTalk possible. The environmental partners, we include Natural Resources Defense Council, Earth Justice, and the Union of Concerned Scientists, all keeping us on the air. We hope you go to their websites, and you can find links to their websites through ours at www.ecotalk.net. They'll give you lots of information about what you can do to green your environment, and again, it does begin at home. So without further delay, I want to welcome Jeff Kluger to the program. He is the one who has put together this story, a series of stories, really, on global warming. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
First of all, I love the cover. You've got a picture of a lone polar bear walking across what looks like kind of slushy ice with kind of a dark background and big lettering saying, "Be worried, be very worried."
Well, that's right. And I think part of our goal here is, while obviously Time doesn't want to put our toes too deeply into advocacy journalism, this feels like it's an issue that utterly transcends political stripe. It's a question of waking people up to the fact that this is a real, imminent, and growing problem, and it would hardly be political advocacy if we warned people of an impending hurricane. Well, it's time to warn them of this impending hurricane.
Or avian flu, or some
that's
other,
exactly,
you know, mad
right.
cow's disease. I mean,
right.
Our environment affects our impacts our health, impacts our economy, and nothing more so than climate change.
Sure,
and
absolutely.
As it says in the subtitle here, climate change isn't some vague future problem. It's already damaging the planet at an alarming pace. And here's how it affects you, your kids, and their kids as well. And that's what we try to do here week in, week out, is connect the dots between planetary health and personal and public health, and on out from there. So
exactly. And that's, I mean, as we were discussing when shortly before we went on the air, Time's last cover story about global warming was about 5 years ago, and in that story, we reached the conclusion that the debate was over, and that the scientific community had reached consensus on this, that the folks who were denying global warming was a problem, or who were still talking about a theorized controversy, were no different from, say, the tobacco industry outliers in the 1990s, who still like to talk about
not enough research.
Controversy,
not
right.
enough research. Well, that was 2001, and clearly the debate was not over. We've heard from a lot of naysayers for the last 4 or 5 years, and many scientists would say that's part of the reason we haven't really taken this on as a country.
Well, exactly right. And I think the key thing, and this was, and I forget who wrote the administration memo, the Republican Party memo, but the famous memo that stressed doubt is your friend, introduce doubt, I'm paraphrasing here,
mm-hmm.
but introduce doubt, introduce uncertainty, and this is how you keep the issue alive. Well, I do think that people both with and without political agendas did just that. The more you introduce doubt, the easier it is for people to tell themselves, these are changes we don't have to make. And I don't think there was necessarily any enormous credulity on the part of voters or consumers. You don't want to think this terrible thing is going to happen, and you don't want the radical lifestyle changes that they believed it would entail. So as long as you hear that it's a scientifically open question, it's very easy to remain complacent.
And what was the tipping point for Time to take on this issue? And it seems like global warming is at a tipping point right now.
Right, it is. There were two things. First of all, it was strictly calendrical. We realized it had been several years since we had attacked this issue in a truly aggressive way, and it was time we did it again. And obviously, the real-world tipping points that have been hit in the last several years, the hurricane season and the droughts and the fires and
Melting glaciers.
Dramatic melt in the in Greenland and in the Arctic and Antarctic. All of these things suggested that the systems are cascading around us at a speed with which even many scientists didn't realize would happen.
In the article, you talk about the feedback loop effect. Why don't you touch on that?
Sure. This is what's accelerating the system as much as it is. And my favorite example of a feedback loop is the way melting ice in at the poles simply begets more melting ice. Ice and snow are very reflective. They reflect 90% of the light and energy that strikes them, which means they carry heat away with them when they reflect it. But as global temperatures start to warm and ice starts to melt, you then replace that ice cover, particularly in the Arctic, with dark ocean water. Well, dark ocean water is precisely the opposite, 90% absorbent, which means 90% of the heat and light and energy that come in from the sun remain in the vicinity of the poles. That means that for every mile of ice you melt, exposing dark heat-absorbing ocean, you make it much easier for the next mile to melt even faster.
Now, I read your article, most of it. It's very comprehensive, and it takes a while, but it's worth every moment. I went and turned on the Today Show this morning and half expected it to be on the news. You know, when you open up the newspaper, why is this not, you know, every day above the fold banner headlines, starting to get into mainstream media, but it's usually not first page? Why does this have to just be kind of stop the press's news that every American pays attention to now?
Well, this calls the amount of conversation I was having earlier in the day when somebody was saying, well, can you really call this an economic crisis and a health crisis and a wildlife and agriculture crisis and everything else? And the answer is, well, sure. I mean, if my house was on fire, it's a furniture crisis and a plumbing crisis and a family crisis and a memento crisis because everything's going to go up in smoke. Well, this is our house. This is the planet. The fact that the only place we can call home is melting, in some cases literally around us, means that it's going to reach down to every level of human society. And the fact that it hasn't made an impact, I think, is I think there are a number of reasons. I do think there's an element of denial involved in it. I also think the glacial creep of science and the glacial creep of environmental science in particular makes it very easy to deny it. If you read an alarming cover in 1990 that warned us of global warming happening, and 3 years later you're still getting a lot of snow in Stowe, Vermont, it's easy for people to say, well, where's this warming I heard about?
You know, what you're saying reminds me of one of my favorite quotes by the late, great Donella Meadows, an educator and environmentalist extraordinaire, and she, I don't have it in front of me, so I won't say it as eloquently as she does, but she talks about how different subjects that are out there in the news all the time that Americans say they're concerned about are players on the field, but the environment, or as I like to say, our environment, is not another player on the field. It is the field that holds up life. And that's, you know, something that those of us who have seen this and been covering this and watching it, and there's so many of us, just not enough Americans have been listening to the environmentalists and the scientists, feel like, you know, when you hear all these polls about what Americans are concerned about in election years, or, you know, all this, you know, controversy about steroids, you just feel like screaming, like, none of that's going to be possible. You know,
well,
not
exactly.
Sports, not stocks, not sex, not scandals, not anything if we don't protect our, you know, our habitat.
That's exactly right. And I also think it's a question of people trying to wrap their brains around two seemingly contradictory ideas, which is that we are very low and humble creatures, and we're very powerful creatures. We're powerful in the sense that we can destroy the climate that we've come to know and the climate that we've come to grow adapted to, and there's no other creature in the world that can do that. On the other hand, we're very low and humble people. We love to talk about the fact that, that you know, we need to save the planet. Well, the planet's going to get on fine without us. If we simply throw off the planetary thermostat and the planetary metabolism, the planet will just slough us off. It may slough off the animals we like as well, but there'll be plenty of forms of plant and wildlife that can thrive in a warmer, wetter world. So we have to remember we are lucky to be adapted to this sweet spot in planetary environment. It's very easy for us to throw that thermostat off, and then we can't live here anymore.
What should we do right now, everybody listening and everybody they know?
Well, there are a lot of things. First of all, it really is important that you talk to your congressman and your senator, write your congressman and your senator. Secondly, there are any number of websites, Environmental Defense, World Wildlife Fund, even BP. Go to these websites. Find out what you can do in your home. Recycling helps. Energy-saving bulbs help. Insulation helps. buy a fuel-efficient car the next time you buy a car. If you can afford it, even if it's a stretch, please buy a hybrid. All of these things make a difference. Just ticking up our mileage standards, a few miles per gallon in the U.S., could actually free us of the quantity of oil we import from the Middle East every year.
I'd like to add one more piece of advice. Listen to EcoTalk and tell everyone you know. This is what we covered, the problem, the solution. Here's what you can do about it. I think you've made a difference, Jeff Kluger, with this article. I am going to encourage everyone. I'm going to give it away as Earth Day presents, this issue of Time Magazine.
Very flattered.
Go out and get it. Your life depends on it. Stay with us. We'll be right back.